Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Social Security when we come back. You know, with an income of $50,000, you're paying $7,650 a year in Social Security taxes if you're self-employed, paying 15.3%. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of $50,000 a second time? Now, you know, the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 in Social Security tax right off the top. Then they turn around and make you pay 17% of that same $50,000 in income tax. Now, that means that you're paying 17% of that $7,650 twice. And that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from everyone that pays this tax. Now, what would you think if Sears or Penny's or your credit card company charged you twice like Social Security and the IRS does? I thought you'd think that was just kind of special. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for the free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free. Now, tax and status, our home school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, last time we were talking about the dollar value of Social Security. What do you get out of it? And I showed you that Social Security has got to be the poorest investment that anybody ever dreamed up. It's a social program that's extremely popular. It was enacted in a social atmosphere in 1935 during the Great Depression. It made Franklin Roosevelt more popular than Jesus. I mean, if Jesus were here running for public office today, he couldn't win public office because the Bible teaches against retirement and Social Security. Social Security is the mark of the beast. I mentioned that to you last night. You can't buy, sell, or trade without it. So if you're wondering what that number is that's spoken of in Revelation 13, verse 16, that you can't buy, sell, or trade without, you've got one right in your back pocket. It's called Social Security. And it's going to become even more pervasive as time progresses along. And it's totally voluntary. Nobody put a gun to your head and forced you to get a Social Security number. Once in a while, someone will say to me, well, I had to get it. It's the law. No, I showed you that it's not the law. There's no law that requires you to get a Social Security number. You have to get a Social Security number in order to attain certain social benefits and certain social goals that you want. I want to work at General Motors, and General Motors requires a Social Security number. But nobody has compelled you to work at General Motors. Now, 13 states require that you have a Social Security number to get a driver's license. 37 states don't. Someone will say, well, I had to get a Social Security number to get a driver's license. No, that's not true either. There's a waiver. There's an exemption. You can come in with an affidavit. I don't have a Social Security number. They'll give you a driver's license without it. There's every group or organization, hospitals, for instance, insurance companies, you know, these institutions will try to coerce you into getting a Social Security number. You know, when you have a baby in the hospital, there's a nurse right there telling you you have to get a Social Security number for the baby. And you don't, but most people do because they're told they have to. And Americans can't say no. So to get along, you go along. And then, of course, there's a cost of doing business later on. You can't pay the income tax without a Social Security number or a taxpayer identification number. It hasn't occurred to too many people that if you don't want to pay the income tax, you shouldn't have a Social Security number or a TIN. And people equate Social Security with retirement. And it's true that Social Security is a retirement program, but it's much more than a retirement program. That's what gets everybody to join up. I want that Social Security retirement program. But it also gives you the income tax. So for all of you tax protesters out there, you owe the income tax because you signed up and volunteered for it when you got your Social Security number. So if you want to stop paying income tax, the first step is to get rid of Social Security. Second step is to stop having income. Third step is start practicing the Ten Commandments, and particularly that one that says, thou shalt not steal. And you'll be able to live your life happily ever after. Now let's begin today's program with Social Security letters. Social Security Administration, in the form letters that they send out, Oh, I don't know how many form letters they have, but I probably got 10 here. I'm going to give you some citations or quotations out of these form letters that they send out to people who have various questions or various problems that come up, and so they'll send you this letter. And I'm going to cite just the relevant parts of each lever. Here's one that went to one of my students one time, and in paragraph 2 it starts off, it says, every worker is free to choose employment that is not covered by Social Security. Do you get that? This is from the Commissioner of Social Security, Baltimore, Maryland, dated August 6, 1984, 20 years ago. Social Security made this admission. Every worker is free to choose employment that is not covered by Social Security. Now somebody will say, well, I'm a carpenter, and carpentry is covered by Social Security. And you're right. You're right. All public employment concerning carpentry is covered. And all private employment not covered by Social Security. There isn't very many jobs. Now, there are some jobs that you cannot do without a Social Security number. I'll concede that. But there's not very many of them. If you want to be a carpenter, plumber, electrician, a doctor, dentist, or something else, you can do all of that privately. Here's a second one. Social Security is a voluntary system in that no one is required to get a number. Now, that's from the Social Security Administration. Do you get that? Did you get that statement right there? It's in paragraph 2 of a letter, Department of Health and Human Services, Social Security Administration, written to another one of my students. So Social Security is a voluntary system in that no one is required to get a number. In paragraph 4, which gets to the nut of the problem, it says, however, a person with no Social Security number would have no taxable income, see paragraph above, and I'm sure this fact would have a bearing on their decision. Now, this deals with borrowing money from a bank. If you want to borrow money from a bank, they're going to ask for a Social Security number. You want to know why? Because people with a Social Security number are taxpayers. They deal in commerce. And when a bank loans you money, it's a commercial loan. And when a bank loans you money, they want to know how you're going to pay it back. And you're going to pay it back out of your income. But what if you didn't have any income? See, a little Georgie Gordon can't borrow money from a bank because I don't have a Social Security number, because I'm not a taxpayer. And without being a taxpayer, I can't make any income. And without any income, how am I going to pay the money back? See how simple that is? So banks aren't stupid, you know. Banks deal in a realm of finance called commerce. And little Georgie Gordon deals in a realm of finance called private business. Now, I want to point out to you that 100 years ago, your great-granddaddy was practicing private business. All Americans did. Government converted all of America's workers into commerce. Now, we've had commerce since the Commerce Clause was created back in 1787. The people engaged in commerce were banks and railroads and commercial businesses and entities that were involved in shipping, for instance. You know, people are building ships and going out and catching whales and bringing them back. That's commerce. And it was taxed. And our federal government operated on impost and ex post taxes. Now, we operate off of income taxes and a whole host and plethora of other taxes that have been levied as excise taxes. An excise tax is a privilege tax. But keep in mind, Social Security now tells you, Social Security is a voluntary system and that no one is required to get a number. Here's a neat letter that we got, and it is a citation from the United States Tax Court. It's the clerk of the United States Tax Court. And it comes from a case called Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce, cited at 168 Fed Second 709. On page 712, listen to this paragraph. The revenue laws are a code or system in regulation of tax assessment and collection. They relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers. No procedure is prescribed for non-taxpayers, and no attempt is made to annul any of their rights and remedies in due course of law. With them, Congress does not assume to deal, and they are neither of the subject nor of the object of the revenue laws. Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce. Write that down, and it'll just blow you away. Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T, versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce, cited at 168 Fed Second, 709, on page 712, U.S. Tax Court. The revenue laws are a code or system in regulation of tax assessment and collection. They relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers. See, if you're going to have a taxpayer, you got to have somebody that's called a non-taxpayer. A five-year-old kid in kindergarten is a non-taxpayer. Did you know that? All right. Now go get a job down at McDonald's. To get a job at McDonald's, you have to have a Social Security number. Well, of course. It's a commercial employment. And you have to have your taxpayer identification number. McDonald's pays you wages, and then you pay your taxes because you're a taxpayer. Now, you don't have to work at McDonald's. Now, most people say, well, I have to work. Well, Jesus said, the poor you have with you always. And poor people are laborers. Poor people are people who go out and work. Well, I tried that one time, and I found out that there's no money in employment. I tested it. Now, if you think that there's money in employment, you don't get after it and go out there and go to work. But I found that the money is in buying, selling, and trading. And I mentioned that to you in the last program. And I said, you buy it for a dollar, you sell it for two, and you make it on 2%. And I had a Jewish guy call me from New York one time. He says, oh, no, Mr. Gordon, that's 100% markup. That's a 50% profit. I said, oh, gosh, I'm glad you called me away from New York and straightened me out on that. most products are priced in what we call a keystone range. So when you're out here buying, selling, and trading, you go into a used car lot and you see the numbers on the windshield, and it says this car is for sale for $49.95. You notice they didn't round it off to $5,000. They wanted to deceive you into believing that this car isn't $5,000, it's $4,000 and some change. Well, $995 is a lot of change out of $1,000. So it's $4,000 and change. It's $4,000 and a lot of change. But the question arises, how much did the guy pay for that car that he put on the lot? You ever think about that? How much do you think that that used car dealer paid for the car that he's selling for $5,000? All right, get your pencil out here and sharpen her up on both ends. I'm going to tell you the answer. He paid $2,500 for that car. $2,500. And you're sitting there saying, well, where did he buy that car for $2,500 that he's going to charge me $5,000 for? He bought it at the auto auction. The auto auction all over America. In some locations, you have to be a registered auto dealer to buy at the auto auction. Now, in Missouri, you don't. We have an auto auction in Jonesboro, Arkansas, in Mansfield, Missouri, the two that I know of. There's another big one, insurance auto auction down in Dallas, Texas. So they're around. See, and that's where they go to buy those cars. And they buy repossessed cars. And they buy cars that go through the auto auctions. And then they mark them up with what we call a keystone market. All right. Now, that's commerce. And they're licensed auto dealers. Now, last time I bought a car through the auto auction, I bought one for about half price. Sometimes you get them for less than half price. Sometimes you get them for maybe 25%, 30, 40% of what they ultimately are going to sell for on the showroom floor. Not the showroom, I shouldn't say the showroom, that's new cars. But well, those new cars also have a keystone markup. And I saw one the other day, and the guys, they're advertising, you know, 5% over invoice. 5% over invoice. You know, I'm an old furniture manufacturer, and I've been in the furniture business for many years. And furniture carries a keystone markup, except the high-end furniture, it has two or three keystones in it. Two or three marks, they call it. Just thought I'd share that with some of you truck drivers out there that maybe don't know. Take that home to Jane, housewife, and tell her that she's getting ripped off down here when they say, well, 75% off. Wife came in the other day and she said, my God, look at this, 75% off. Well, it's a marketing technique. See, it makes you feel good when you go in, you pay $15 for something in a store that's marked down 75%. Doesn't that make you feel real good? God, I scored big today. I only paid 25% for this product over here. So the product, you know, is selling for $15. Okay, and they put a tag on this product here, and it's $35, $40, marked down to 15. Everything goes floor to ceiling, wall to wall, regardless of cost, loss, or value. I know those lines, I invented them. I used to be in the liquidation business. I know how that goes. But the truth of the matter is, that thing never did cost the guy that's selling it, you know, $20, and he was trying to sell it for 40. Marked it down to 15 so that he's losing $5. Now, he paid $5 for that product. And then he puts a tag on there and reduced from $40 to $15 makes you feel real good. So you buy it for the $15. So he makes his full markup. The stuff's coming from China, boys and girls. And yeah, if it was made here in the United States, it probably would be a $40 item, but it's coming from China. And those Chinese produce it for $5, ship it over here. And when you get the freight into it and you put it on the shelf over here, it costs you $7.50 and you sell it for $15. But it really makes people feel good when it's marked down from $40 and 75% off. You know, they're lying to you, but it makes you feel good. And if you feel good, I guess that's what you ought to do. Here's another letter. Here's from Social Security, written to one of my students over here, dated October 18th, 1985, 21 years ago. Listen to this admission, 21 years ago. Yeah, this isn't something new that just happened last week. I mean, this has been around forever. The form letter says, to our knowledge, no organization can require an employer to provide or deny employment to people who refuse to disclose their Social Security numbers. Any problems that an individual has over employment for this reason is between the employee and his employer. That paragraph says, just leave Social Security and IRS out of it. Next paragraph says, an individual who does not wish to use his Social Security number can request his employer to enter the phrase religious objector, refuses to provide a Social Security number or some other appropriate remark in the space provided for the Social Security number when reporting earnings. However, even if the employer agrees to do so, the individual must still pay Social Security taxes if the job is covered by Social Security. So if you worked at McDonald's, your local McDonald's franchise holder over there doesn't have to have a Social Security number to hire you. He can pay this Social Security tax over to the suspense fund. And he can put religious objector in the line that says Social Security number. Now, most employers won't do that. And in fact, most of them don't even know that they could because they're not trained in law and they rely upon their accountants, bookkeepers, and tax attorneys for their advice. Accountants and bookkeepers and tax attorneys work for the government as enrolled agents. And as enrolled agents, they're there to sell Social Security and income tax. It's their livelihood. It's what they market. It's what they sell. Just like the hospital administrator is there to promote a policy of getting a Social Security number assigned to every baby born in the hospital. is to get a birth certificate registered and recorded to every baby that's born in a hospital. You don't have to get a birth certificate. You don't have to get a social security number, but they're going to put pressure on you. They're going to tell you that you need one. They're going to tell you that you have to have one. And people that are weak-willed and can't say no probably need a guardian. They probably need a birth certificate and a social security number. I'm not a postcode. I'm not telling you not to get one. You know, maybe you need one. I don't know. I just know that I don't need one, and I don't want one. I'm not going to get one. And there's a few of you people out there that are in the same boat. And if you are, I just wanted to share with you some information here. Let's take a look at another letter dated August 23rd, 1979. Listen, this is a neat admission from Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, Social Security Administration, Baltimore, Maryland. Your Social Security number and record will not be used at all unless you yourself activate the record by using it for employment or other purposes. Every time somebody asks you for a Social Security number, you activate that Social Security number, you personally. Your Social Security number and record will not be used at all unless you yourself activate the record by using it for employment or other purposes. So it's a voluntary act on your part, and you have to do it. Now, if somebody comes up and says, lay down and spread your legs, ladies, does that mean that you have to do that? Could you say no? Could you say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not a whore. I mean, you know, some girls can't. Some girls, they just have to lay down and spread their legs. But, you know, there's other girls that say, no, I'm not going to do that. Okay. It's a wild new concept for some of you, but think about it. As Mr. Jennings advised you in his July 13th letter, you should request present and future employers to enter the phrase religious objector in the space provided for your Social Security number when they report your wages and taxes. And you may show this letter to your employer to show that your request is valid. That's an old letter, August 23rd, 79. I'll bet you that they don't advise people to do that anymore. Religious objector. Do you ever think of that? Here's another letter, dated 1980, December 4th, 1980, Department of Health, Human Services, Social Security Administration. Listen to this neat admission. Whether or not you use your Social Security number is a personal decision that you must make each time someone requests it. Here's your advisor, Social Security. It says, hey, listen, boys and girls, whether or not you use your Social Security number is a personal decision. Now, I gave you the Denny's waitress test. You know, if you were in a Denny's waitress and she came over and said, are you bisexual, homosexual, or are you something else? And you say, well, let me fill out the form over here and let me write that down. Do you have hemorrhoids? Have you ever had TB, AIDS, syphilis, gonorrhea, or any other sexually transmitted disease? I mean, if you want to answer those questions for a Denny's waitress, it's a personal decision that you must make every time somebody asks it. So when I'm sitting down here, somebody brings me a form and they want to ask me a lot of questions. You know, I look at the form and I say to myself, well, gee, do I want to answer these questions? It's a personal decision. Oftentimes I tell them, you know, I don't think I'm going to tell you the answer to that. Here's another neat admission. The Social Security Administration does not have the authority to require an organization to provide or deny employment or services to anyone who refuses to disclose their number. Thus, any difficulties that you encounter over employment and wages are between you and your employer. Now, I mentioned that to you last time. I said, the government doesn't require you to get a Social Security number. That's voluntary. It's General Motors and it's McDonald's that requires that you get a Social Security number to work for this corporation. Yeah, it's not the government. They've foisted that off. They've foisted that off onto the corporation. So it's between you and your employer. The government's out of the loop over here altogether. So the government has imposed Social Security upon corporations. And we'll take a look at that next one. We look at Hale versus Hinkle. How does government enforce these laws upon corporations? And then the corporations go out and enforce these laws upon you. Now, since 9/11, you'll notice that we've had some very strict airport security. Have you noticed that? And it's a totalitarian police state mentality that we now have in our airports. I haven't been abused by anybody in the airports. Not a one. Not a single Homeland Security officer has looked up my rectum to see if I'm carrying explosives. I haven't taken off one shoe to be exposed, to be inspected by anybody in the airport to inspect me to see if I'm qualified to fly on an airplane. Because I already know I'm not qualified, so I don't go to airports. I haven't been on an airplane since 9/11. Not one. And you know, 5 million foreign tourists a year no longer come to the United States because of the strict airport security. 5 million tourists a year. I mentioned that to you the other day. I got a letter, you know, from Carnival Cruises, and they said, hey, listen, after these four hurricanes came, sir, we'd like your business, so why don't you jump on an airplane, come down here to Miami and jump on this Carnival cruise for $199. I told the wife, I said, wow, $199, Carnival cruise, 3 days, $50 a day on a luxury liner. I mean, you know, obviously they're losing money, but they want to, you know, it's a promotion, and they want to get people to go back to Florida after these hurricanes. And I wrote them a letter, and I said, geez, I'd be happy to do that, but I can't get on an airplane. So it's not just me. It's 5 million other tourists from around the world. I just saw this the other day in the Chapman newsletter. You know, Bob Chapman, the international forecaster. Now, think of that, all of you people that work in the tourist industry. And you know, there's people with money that would like to travel, and they can't travel because of Homeland Security and government interference in the industry. And the airlines are going broke. Did you see United Airlines the other day? They've been in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and they scuttled their pension program. See, they can't make ends meet. Well, I'll bet you United could probably make ends meet if they could get their share of those 5 million tourists that would like to come to the United States but can't because they can't qualify. Of course, all of you Americans are safer. Oh, my God. You know, they're protecting you from terrorism. After all, you do want to be protected from terrorism, don't you? I pointed this out, that terrorism from 1980 through 2001, you know, the terrorist attack, hadn't killed 5,000 people in 20 years, in 21 years, hadn't killed 5,000 people. Hell, you kill 40 or 50,000 people every year in automobiles. I mean, if you impose the same kind of draconian tactics that you're imposing upon airlines and Homeland Security and all this crap over here, well, you could shut America down over automobiles. I mean, we'd have to abolish the automobile industry because it kills 40,000 people every year and has been for the last 100 years. You know, terrorists kill so few people that it isn't even a blip on the radar scheme. Your chances of getting killed in a terrorist activity are so low. I mean, you know, you stand a better chance of getting killed in a car wreck. You probably stand a better chance of getting killed in a plane wreck or a train wreck than you do of being killed by a terrorist. And you're spending $37 billion a year on Homeland Security. $37 billion a year. Well, if you spent that kind of money on education, well, you know, you'd be doing something, wouldn't you? Now, the Social Security Administration does not have the authority to require an organization to provide or deny employment or services to anyone who refuses to disclose their number. So you can't go to Social Security, you know, and say, hey, listen, I got this problem over here. Fix it for me. They just tell you plainly it's not our problem. We're not involved in that. The Social Security Act does not require any individual to have a Social Security number to live and work in the United States, nor does it require a Social Security number simply for the purpose of having one. However, if a person works without a Social Security number, we cannot properly credit that person's earnings. This is written to one of my students in March of 1995. So, as recently as 10 years ago, listen to this citation again. This is from the Social Security Administration, Department of Human Services, March 15, 1995, paragraph 123. Paragraph 3 says, the Social Security Act does not require any individual to have a Social Security number to live and work in the United States. I mean, this is right out of Social Security, which is what I just reported to you, remember, from Larry Becraft. Remember that Larry Becraft website, http://fly.highway.net. Now that highway is the curious one. It's spelled H-I-W-A-A-Y. There's two A's in that way. That's http://fly.highway.net. Remember to put two A's in that highway. That's Larry Becraft's website, Huntsville, Alabama. Wrote a number of briefs, and I think are on his website. Several of those briefs that I've used over the years, he sent them to me, and I gave him credit for it. Social Security Act does not require any individual to have a Social Security number to live and work in the United States, nor does it require a Social Security number simply for the purpose of having one. However, if a person works without a Social Security number, we cannot properly credit the person's earnings. Well, who wants his earnings credited? Who wants a Social Security number? Who wants to work for earnings? Wouldn't you be better off if you were working for money? Well, there's the Social Security letters. We're at the halfway point here, boys and girls. So let me take a break right here, and we'll give you a couple of reminders, and we'll take a look at Hale versus Hinkle and the George Rapp Society here when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by pre-arrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, go to the homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio logs and schedule and archives. Schedule and archives. All of these programs, you know, sometimes you'll be listening to a program on the radio, and you'll say, God, I wish I could get that program. Well, you can't. If you'll go to georgegordon.org, go to the archive, you can download this program on 16 or 32-bit. And you can rebroadcast this over the radio if you want. That's what a lot of people do, radio stations around the world. They take the program, and they just download it. They get free program. Makes them feel good. Gives us free advertising. Makes us feel good. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and we offer a free 4-hour introductory CD package. So if you'd like to order yours, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And then finally, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or staff of this network, or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the website georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, let's take a look at Hale versus Hinkle. Way back in the olden days, 1905, the American Tobacco Company got into trouble with the IRS. That isn't so spectacular. A lot of corporations get in trouble with government agencies, but the company controller decided that he was going to apply the Bill of Rights to this corporation against the IRS. So he said, listen, we're not going to bring in our records and books without a court order, without a search warrant. Well, the case wound its way through the judicial system all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court weighed in on the subject, discussing the rights of individuals versus the rights, privileges, franchises, and immunities of corporations. And this is a common doctrine. It's been around for 100 years. And this is where judges and bureaucrats go to get the guidance that they need to make decisions concerning rights, privileges, and immunities. They go to the courts, and here's one of those famous court decisions. Listen to this. Conceding that the witness was an officer of the corporation under investigation and that he was entitled to assert the rights of the corporation with respect to the production of its books and papers, we are of the opinion that there is a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. So if you're an individual and you've been subpoenaed into federal district court and this federal judge said to you, this is a show cause hearing, can you show cause as to why I shouldn't hold you in contempt for refusing to show your records and books to the IRS? So you get an IRS summons and it says, well, come on in here for an audit and we want to look at your records and books. And you get a little uppity and you say, well, wait a minute, these guys, you know, they're just running roughshod over me. Why, they've got to have a search warrant. Why, they've got to have, you know, they got to go through due process and equal protection. I mean, you went to high school and you went to college and you learned that somewhere in civics, didn't you? Then somebody back there tell you something about the Fourth Amendment and search warrants, and so you say to yourself, well, they just can't run roughshod over me like that, can they? So it raises an interesting legal question, and the question is this: does contract supersede or follow your rights? Or put another way, do your rights supersede or follow contract? I guess we could word it like this: can you contract your rights away? I mean, can you sign a contract over here with Best Buy or Bank of America or MasterCard and contract your rights away? Can these corporations drop a contract that would cause you to waive, lose, or abrogate any of your civil or constitutional rights? Does that ever happen? Is it legal? And the answer is yes. Yes, they can. A very common way that corporations do that is in the terms and conditions of the contract concerning, we'll say, a credit card. Now, normally, when you have a dispute with somebody, you take them to court and you sue them. It's the process that was designed by God out at Mount Sinai, litigation. You'll see that in Exodus chapter 18. If you want to know why Anglo-Saxons, and particularly Americans, are litigious people, we get it from the Bible. It's part of our Anglo-Saxon administration. It's a part of our heritage. Well, it's either that or dueling pistols at dawn. It's either that or war. You know, you got to settle this controversy some way or another. And so the way that we Anglo-Saxons settle it is you sue the bastard. That's how simple that is. So when you go out here and you have a conflict, let's say, with MasterCard, you take them in and you sue them, and then a jury listens to all matters in excess of $20 under the Seventh Amendment. Remember that? In controversies in excess of $20, you're entitled to a jury trial. Well, listen, MasterCard and Bank of America and all these major corporations, they don't want to get hauled into court and sued every time they screw somebody over. So they just write a clause in the contract that you agree with the bank that if there's a conflict or a controversy, that you and the bank will submit to binding arbitration. So there are arbitration companies out there. So Bank of America, being a big corporation, goes out and creates an arbitration company. And then guess what arbitration company Bank of America goes to for arbitration that you agree to when you sign on the dotted line to get the Bank of America card or the Visa card? If you're surprised that it's an arbitration company owned by Bank of America, you are indeed naive, boys and girls. So that's the way they get around that. And so what happens is you can contract away your right to sue. You can contract away your Seventh Amendment right, if you so desire. That's why it's so important that you read the terms and conditions, and they always make them in fine print. Do you ever notice that? If you take a look at these contracts, you can't read the print. Well, when you get to be an old man like me, you can't read the print. So I have this 10-power loop that fits right over my head. See, I collect coins, and so I got one of these coin magnifying glasses, and it just fits right over my head. It's got a loop, and I just strap it on here, and I pull the visor down, and there's my 10-power loop right there, and I can read contracts. Boy, can I read contracts. I couldn't count till I was 37. Well, about the same time I learned how to read. Gosh, you'd be amazed. You'd be amazed at these lawyers that work for these major corporations about how they circumvent your constitutional rights and stick that right into the contract and then stick it right up your hiney sideways when you have a conflict with these corporations. Which sends me a signal. That's why I don't have any credit cards. I don't know why I'd want to have a credit card. They're going to lie to me and steal from me anyway. And I came to a conclusion years ago. I figured out that if you never do business with a thief, you'll never be stolen from. So if you don't want to be stolen from, there are two institutions you want to stay away from. That's government and corporate business. Government and corporate business. You stay away from those fascist corporations in bed with your fascist government, and you won't be stolen from anymore. Now, if you can eliminate those thieves, you'll get those thieves out of your back pockets, you'll have a lot more money left over to go out there and shop at Walmart. All right, now, Hale versus Hinkle, notice here that this examination at the suit of the state, they're talking about corporations and individuals, and they're going to separate these out for us. So listen to this individual here, his first paragraph. The Supreme Court tells us that the individual, and that's you, Joe, Joe and Sally Housewife, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, the individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. Did you know that? You can stand upon your constitutional rights as a citizen. You are entitled to carry on your private business in your own way. Your power to contract is unlimited. You owe no duty to the state or to your neighbors to divulge your business or to open your doors to an investigation so far as it may tend to incriminate you. You owe no such duty to the state since you receive nothing therefrom beyond the protection of your life and property. Your rights are such as existed by the law of the land, the common law, antecedent to the organization of the state, and can only be taken from you by due process of law and in accordance with the Constitution. And among your rights are a refusal to incriminate yourself and the immunity of yourself and your property from arrest or seizure except under a warrant of the law. You owe nothing to the public so long as you do not trespass upon their rights. Did you know that you had that kind of power guaranteed you under the Constitution? That's a pretty powerful statement. You'll find that on page 74 of Hale versus Hinkle, and that's cited at 201 U.S. 43. So you go to the U.S. Supreme Court Reports, volume 201, turn to page 43, and there's Hale versus Hinkle. Now flip over to page 75, and you can read that citation right there that I just read to you. That's just in case you want to check up on me and see if I'm lying to you. And by the way, I didn't write that. Hell, I'm not even smart enough to write that. That was written by the Supreme Court of the United States in 1905. And they went on. They went a step further than that. They said, not only are those your rights as an individual, let us tell you what the rights and the obligations of a corporation are. Let's delineate that. Let's show you the difference now between you and a corporation. So in the next paragraph, it says, on the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state. The corporation is presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. Corporations receive certain special privileges and franchise and holds those privileges and franchises subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of that corporate charter. Corporate powers are limited by law. Corporations can make no contracts not authorized by their charters. Corporations' rights to act as a corporation are only preserved to it so long as it obeys the laws of its creation. And there's a reserved right in the legislature to investigate corporate contracts and to find out whether those corporations have exceeded their powers. It would be a strange anomaly to hold that a state, having chartered a corporation to make use of certain franchises, could not, in the exercise of its sovereignty, require as to how those franchises had been employed and whether they had been abused, and demand the production of corporate books and papers for that purpose. So, corporations don't have very many rights, don't have very many privileges or immunities. So when the state sues a corporation, like they did here, they brought in the American Tobacco Company and said, produce your books and papers, they didn't have any choice, they had to. Because they were created by the state. But you see, boys and girls, you weren't created by the state. You were created by God. You have rights. You are a little higher than a corporation. Now, of course, if you don't like that, you know, you want to be usual and ordinary. God made an observation one time. He said, he called us a peculiar people, and he said he wanted us to behave in a peculiar way. That's why he wanted you to practice the Ten Commandments instead of the Ten Planks of the Communist Manifesto. Most people don't want to practice the Ten Commandments. They want to practice the Ten Planks of the Communist Manifesto so they can be usual and ordinary because they don't want to be peculiar. People that are peculiar stand out. You know, people that are peculiar are individuals. Corporations are pretty usual and ordinary. So when you go down and sign up with the MasterCard company or Visa, you become pretty usual and ordinary. And then you subscribe to this corporate contract. See, you join corporate capacity. And this Visa card deals in Federal Reserve Note dollars, doesn't it? And Federal Reserve Note dollars are taxed, aren't they? And then you want to go down and work for General Motors or McDonald's or some corporation, and you do. So you join corporate capacity by filling out a W-4 form, don't you? And so you join the income tax, because you got to have a social security number to work there. You see where you're going here, boys and girls? You become the proximate cause of your own injury. That's what the bottom line is. All right, let's take a look here at an operation called the George Rapp Harmony Society. The George Rapp Society was the first successful communistic and religious organization in the United States. The society was designed for profit-making for some, and its formula included a controlled economy under limited liability. Now, limited liability is the opposite of insurance, which is the same ingredient of the Federal Reserve formula that's running our country today. This is the formula that has brought admiralty inland and has barred our access to substantive common law. George Rapp founded the Harmony Society in 1805 at Harmony in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, and he subsequently moved to Harmony on the Wabash in the state of Indiana, and then moved to Economy in Beaver County, Pennsylvania. Now, the nature of this society was brought to light in the case of Schreiber v. Rapp in 1836, which was heard before the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And this case was an action brought by Jacob Schreiber, who was the administrator of Peter Schreiber, deceased, against George Rapp and others doing business in company under the name of the Harmony Society. To sustain the action, the plaintiff proved by testimony that the Harmony Society possessed a great deal of wealth in the form of personal property, real property, factories, and so on. It was a pool of property, a commune, we'd call it today. Now, witness Dr. Smith, who was once a member of the association, stated, quote, here's Smith's testimony, they intended to make money when they entered into it. It was a part of their object. I believe there were articles at Harmony, but everyone was not obliged to sign it. Equal rights, equal enjoyments, and equal profits. Rapp said it should not be incorporated, for that would take too much power from him. Rapp was not elected. He assumed the power that Moses and Aaron had. And if anyone should or would not do what he said, he would say, what have you to do about it? I have the power. I could crush you. All you have to do is obey. And he got worse as he got wealthy. Well, George Rapp was a preacher, and he was a very persuasive preacher. Adam Shelley testified on behalf of the plaintiff respecting the first articles of association on the Wabash. And here's what Adam Shelley testified to. Quote, the people were directed to come in companies. One of them read it, and the rest of them signed it. As to the article signed at Economy, Rapp made a long speech and said that anyone who would sign it would have his name written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And if they did not, their names would be blotted out, and God would ask him about it. All right, now this is the George Rapp Harmony Society. This is the pattern that Social Security was taken out of. Now, the guy that formulated Social Security, the guru behind it, was a guy by the name of Arthur Altmaier. He was a New Deal Democrat from Minnesota. New Deal Democrat, came over to Washington from Minnesota. Arthur Altmaier was his name. And he took this George Rapp Harmony Society, and he took that as the pattern, and he wrote up the Social Security Act of 1935. And so, let's take five of these articles out of the Rapp Society. And let me show you what you signed up for. Just exactly what you've signed up for under Social Security. Now, the defendants, to sustain the issue on their part, produced in evidence the Articles of Association. Now, here are some of the pertinent excerpts that are as follows. These are the legal principles that are put into the Social Security Act. And by the way, you can read the Social Security Act, your contract that you have under the Social Security Act. It's in Title 42 of the U.S. Code. Title 42, Section 301. Through Section 335, 301 to 335, 35 sections under Title 42. Comes right out of the Rapp Society. And so here's what Arthur Altmaier signed up for. Article 1, we the undersigned for ourselves and our heirs, executors and administrators, do hereby give, grant, and forever convey to the said George Rapp and his associates and their heirs and assigns all of our property for the benefit of the said association or community. That's exactly what you do under Social Security. You give all of your property and property rights under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property. To the government. Isn't that special? Article 2. We do further covenant and agree to, and with the said George Rapp and his associates, that we will severally submit faithfully to the laws and regulations of the said community, therefore holding ourselves bound to promote the interest and welfare of the said community, not only by the labor of our own hands, but also by that of our children, our families, and all others who now are or hereafter may be under our control. Article 3, that we will never claim or demand either for ourselves, our children, or for anyone belonging to us, directly or indirectly, any compensation, wages, or reward, whatever, for our or their labor or services rendered to the said community. You know, you people are out there working for Federal Reserve notes. It's called a discharge in equity rather than a payment at law. You've never been paid. If you were born after 1965, you have never been paid in the United States of America. Isn't that special? We used to have payment in this country with gold and silver coin, but we abrogated that. Article 5. The said George Rapp and his associates further agree to supply the undersigned severally with all the necessaries of life and to such extent as their circumstances may require. There's your security blanket. That's your safety net. Social Security has 108 of these provisions in the social safety net. Article 6. If any of the undersigned should withdraw from the association, then the said George Rapp and his associates agree to refund to him or them the value of all such property without interest. Social Security works that way. You don't get your interest. Remember, we showed you yesterday. If you put that in the bank, your Social Security money, the money that you're having withdrawn from your checks every week, if you put that in the bank at 5% interest, it would triple in 40 years. You don't get any of that. They don't even give you back the principal. They give you a portion of the principal without interest, as he or they may have brought into the community. Said value to be refunded, as it said, George Rapp and his associates shall determine. You don't have any input into Social Security. Congress writes the contract. It's called an adhesion contract. You just take it or leave it. Now, the court ruled for the defendant, George Rapp, on the basis that an association for the purpose expressed is prohibited neither by statute nor by the common law. And it is supposed, however, said the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, it is supposed, however, that as the intestate had power by the articles to secede from the society and to take out whatever he had brought into it, the successor to his personal rights may exercise it as his representative. Such, however, are not the terms of the articles. The right of accession, therefore, is intransmissible. So you put your property, your dollars, your labor, your money into Social Security, but you can't even take that out. Under the Rap Society, if you want it out, you know, you could say, well, I want out, so give me my money back. It wouldn't pay any interest, but they give you your property. Under the Social Security Act that Arthur Altmaier came up with, he came up with a new twist. Once in, always in. And once you join Social Security, you don't ever get your property back. Now, you get to be age 65, and under the law as it's currently written, and you can get this law, by the way, and you can get all of the statistics, all of the numbers, all of the benefits that you're entitled to, and the payments that you're going to be making from the Social Security website. Social Security has a website, and these numbers that I'm giving you can write off that website. They lie a lot, but you know, even if you take their lies and just apply the numbers to their lies, it ought to tell you that this thing is an abortion at best. It's an abortion at best. So an analysis of this case reveals that the complaint was brought under the jurisdiction of the common law. The plaintiff lost because the common law and constitutionally protected right to contract. He contracted his rights away. And that's what you did with Social Security. You contracted your constitutional rights away. Under the common law, the only way to break the contract was to prove fraud. And according to testimony, the members of the association intended to make money when they entered into it. When you join Social Security, you intend to make money. You intend, when you join Social Security, that you're going to get these benefits. There are benefits associated with Social Security. Now, of course, those benefits that you're going to get out of Social Security are few and far between, aren't they? I'll say they're few and far between. They're non-existent. When Social Security gets through with your money after 40 or 45 years, if you're in the high-end bracket, you're going to get back 20 cents on the dollar. $1 out of every $5 that you pay and you get back. If you're in the middle income brackets, that is, you're a $20 an hour man, you're working in the trades, for every $2.73 that you pay in, you get a dollar back. The best deal is when you're a minimum wage earner and you're paying in a dollar, you get 68 cents back. They only charge you 32 cents to administer the program. They charge you one-third when you're poor. Guess that's the benefits of being poor. All right, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night talking about Social Security, and I'll give you some more of these exciting pieces of information about your welfare state program, Social Security. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. Says time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.